Commander Ian Park is a barrister in the Royal Navy, specializes in international law. He has been deployed as a legal advisor on operations to Afghanistan and to the Middle East. He holds a doctorate in law from Balliol College, Oxford, and published among its publications a book on the right to life in armed conflict by OUP 2018. He has lectured in many most prominent places, including Harvard Law School, Oxford University, Beijing, Hanoi University, Shanghai Jia Tong, Freiburg University, and of course, Cambridge University. He was a Mountbatten Fellow at St. John's College, Cambridge, and I think since 2018 has been helping us with a law class lecturing and joining in workshops, leading workshops on topical issues of the law of armed conflict and new technologies and the dilemmas of targeting and modern warfare. He has been so kind with his time, so generous with us with his time, and we are thankful and grateful for this. And also for this lunchtime lecture on the role of military legal advisor during armed conflict and peacetime military operations. So people wishing to ask a question, please use the Q&A function, not the chat, and we'll have ample time for a Q&A at the end of the lecture. We have 1 hour and for this, and Dr. Park, the floor is yours. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Eyal. Hello, everyone. I hope you're all as well as can be expected. Thank you very much indeed for tuning in. I was speaking with some LLM students at Cambridge last Thursday, and partway through the class, my 8-year-old daughter decided to practice her piano, which was an interesting musical interlude. Hopefully today's session will go off without any, I think it was ABBA she was playing, so hopefully we'll be able to avoid that. Before I start, I would like to really say thank you to the Lauterpacht Centre and its fellows. As a military lawyer, we do have doctrine to rely upon. We have the UK Manual of the Law of Armed Conflict. But of course, many legal issues and questions arise where we have to call upon learned academic texts. And many of them have been written by fellows at the Lauterpacht Centre. And for many years, I've read the work of, amongst others, Professors Eyal Benvenisti, Mark Weller, Christine Gray, Dr. Sandesh Sivakumaran, Andrew Sanger, Tom Grant, Giovanni Mantilla, and many others. And I also recognise the work of the British Red Cross Research Fellows at the Lauterpacht Centre as well. So thank you very much indeed. The work of the centre makes my work immeasurably easier. What I'd like to do over the next 40 minutes or so is really look at four issues. Firstly, I'd like to begin with a few general remarks about the role of legal advisors in the armed forces. Secondly, I would like to consider some legal lessons, some observations from recent armed conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. I'd thirdly like to offer some observations in respect of what has been termed lawfare, or the judicialization of warfare, as it's been called by the Policy Exchange in London. And then fourthly and finally, I would like to gaze into a crystal ball and consider what the future might hold. Firstly, in terms of the nature of warfare, and secondly, the role of law therein. I'd also like to stress at the outset that The views I express are my own and not those of the UK Ministry of Defence or the UK government. So firstly, in terms of some general remarks and observations, since I was called to the bar in 2003 and started to practice as a barrister in the Royal Navy, the number of lawyers in naval legal services has almost doubled since that time. And that has really been driven by demand, both in terms of the volume of work and the complexity of the work that we are asked to do. And it requires a specialist knowledge, and often we have gone off to gain further academic qualifications to assist in our work. At present, we have an enduring presence with a legal advisor permanently based at the UK Maritime Component Command, the Combined Maritime Force in Bahrain. We have a lawyer on the staff of the US Navy JAG at the Pentagon in the international and operational law team there. And we have a lawyer on the staff of the Carrier Strike Group. And that lawyer will sail with the aircraft carrier Queen Elizabeth when the Queen Elizabeth sails on the maiden deployment later this year. So it's certainly a growth industry being a military lawyer at present. Secondly, looking at some legal lessons or some observations from recent conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. There are really six main points or themes I would like to draw out. The first one is training. Now, of course, states have got legal obligations pursuant to Articles 82 and 83 of Additional Protocol 1 to the Geneva Conventions that cover the role of legal advisors and the dissemination of the conventions. But in terms of training, there is a key role to play for legal advisors, both in terms of the use of force in armed conflict and also the conduct of armed forces personnel in respect to detention of captured personnel and their conduct in relation to that. And of course, in both of these areas, there has been a significant amount of litigation, and some of that litigation continues. And I'll mention more about that as this talk progresses. The second point is a related point, and that is to do with the keeping of accurate and contemporaneous records and notes and having an archive. In this way, if states do that during armed conflict, then of course they will have something to refer back to in the event of future litigation, public inquiries, etc. And I think it's absolutely vital that during armed conflict, these records are kept accurately and are checked. The third observation is in respect of resources. By that, I mean having sufficient resources present, both in terms of personnel and their expertise and everything to support that, to conduct investigations during armed conflict when they are required. Because of course, if contemporaneous investigations can be conducted during armed conflict, this might in some way alleviate the requirement to do it after the event. Fourthly, there needs to be sufficient oversight and accountability of armed forces personnel. And this is made more difficult, of course, with the military being a rank-based hierarchical organization. But it is possible to have individuals who are independent of the military chain of command, whether they be military police or lawyers, who can provide some oversight and assist in accountability when it comes to decision making, potentially in respect of, for example, the use of lethal force, or in terms of providing oversight of detention facilities and the conduct in respect of captured personnel. The fifth point is it has a legal dimension, but it really relates to thinking to the end of the conflict and thereafter in terms of what is the exit strategy in respect of any armed conflict or military operation overseas, and also how does the law fit into that, and what will be the legal regime in place when the armed forces leave. And the final point, the sixth point, is, and it might sound obvious, but clearly it's absolutely imperative to know the law. And by that, I mean what law is specifically applicable at any given point in time. Is it elements of international humanitarian law? Is it elements of international human rights law? Is it both? This will be determined in part by the nature of the armed conflict, whether it be an international armed conflict, non-international occupation, and also potentially the phase of any military operation. One only needs to look at the recent European Court of Human Rights judgment in Georgia, Russia number two, to see that that court at least has placed some emphasis on the phase of hostilities. And I will mention more on that subject when we come onto it in a moment. So I would suggest that in all of those areas, there are potentially lessons that have been learned and relevant observations. We should ask why these lessons and observations are important. Well, of course, they are the right thing to do. But if we do these things, we will be in a position to effectively defend against future litigation, to assist in public inquiries, to protect the reputation of armed forces and in turn the state, to assist in maintaining legitimacy in resort to and in the use of armed force, and if a state espouses and values a rules-based international order, then if that state conforms with its legal obligations, then it would avoid charges of hypocrisy. The cost of failure, of course, is very high, and most importantly, in respect of the human cost in terms of loss of life. But in addition to that, states often carry a significant burden in terms of investigations, inquiries, and litigation many years after an armed conflict has come to an end. If we look at Iraq, for example, the Al-Sweedy inquiry that was launched by the Labour government in 2009 following a judicial review that was brought by the uncle of Hamid Al-Sweedy, who claimed his nephew had been unlawfully killed whilst in the custody of British troops. That inquiry lasted 5 years and cost almost £25 million. The report at the end of it said that in certain aspects, the way in which the detainees were treated amounted to actual or possible ill treatment. However, it went on to say that the vast majority of the allegations were found to be wholly without merit or justification and were the result of deliberate and calculated lies or inappropriate or reckless speculation. But nonetheless, the inquiry had to be conducted, as I say, at some considerable cost over many years. The work of the Iraq Historic Allegations team falls into a similar category that was followed by the Service Police Legacy Investigations that concluded in June of 2020. So clearly these investigations and inquiries use up a considerable amount of resource that potentially could be alleviated or avoided in part if a state had recourse to more accurate records potentially and had a very good idea as to precisely what was happening and when during an armed conflict. And I'm not suggesting it's easy, but it perhaps would help a little. This isn't, of course, unique to the armed conflict in Iraq. Operation Northmoor was an independent Royal Military Police investigation into the conduct of UK armed forces in Afghanistan. That cost in the region of £10 million and has run for a number of years. In July of 2019, it was brought to an end. And it has been stated that no case investigated as part of Operation Northmoor was referred for prosecution by the Independent Service Prosecuting Authority. This is not, however, unique to the UK armed forces by any stretch of the imagination. We have seen these sorts of issues elsewhere. Most recently, in respect of some of the revelations in Australia, with specific reference to the conduct of their special forces in Afghanistan. So clearly, these are observations and lessons that have applicability beyond the UK. And I suppose ultimately, the most important point is that armed forces, when deployed on military operations, must act in accordance with the law. And I would suggest that military legal advisors do have a key role in ensuring that that does happen. I would now like to move on to offer a few thoughts and observations in respect of what has been called or termed lawfare. It has been contended by some that law is increasingly being used as a method of warfare. States, most notably China and Russia, are using myriad legal strategies to advance their interests, undermine their adversaries, and in the case of China, potentially assist in tipping the geopolitical and military scales in their favor. Cognizant of international law norms, non-state actors are also exploiting states' legal constraints to gain a military advantage on the battlefield, most graphically through the use of human shields. Lawfare, therefore, has moved beyond any initial conception of using law as a means of realizing a military objective to permeate many aspects of military and political activity. I would also argue that lawfare has moved significantly beyond the narrow confines of the applicability of international human rights law to armed conflict, or as some would see it, the deleterious effect of historic criminal charges being brought against former armed forces personnel. Both issues, that is to say, international human rights law and armed conflict and historic investigations, are addressed in the Overseas Operations, Service Personnel and Veterans Bill, which was presented on the 18th of March 2020 and is currently before the UK Parliament, having received its second reading in the House of Lords on the 20th of January of this year. The main purpose of the bill, set out by the government, is to provide greater legal protections to armed forces personnel and veterans serving on military operations overseas. The bill reflects a promise made by the Conservative Party in December of 2019 upon their re-election to tackle vexatious legal claims that undermine our armed forces. That being a direct quote from the time. The bill itself has three main facets. The first is the intention to create what has been termed a triple lock. That consists of a presumption against prosecution for alleged offences that were committed more than 5 years ago. Secondly, a requirement for prosecutors to give weight to certain matters when reaching decisions in such cases. And third part of the triple lock, a requirement to obtain the consent of the Attorney General or the Advocate General in Northern Ireland before any prosecution can proceed. The second facet of the bill is that it would introduce time limits on bringing civil claims in connection to overseas operations. And the final facet of the bill is it would place a duty on the government to consider derogating from the European Convention on Human Rights in relation to significant overseas military operations. I think it's fair to say, like many pieces of legislation, the response to this bill has been mixed. Some take the view that the bill hasn't gone far enough to protect members of the armed forces, and others take the opposing view. And I think on balance, it is probably unlikely that the bill will set out to achieve all it does. There's a number of reasons for that. Firstly, in the schedules to the bill, there are any number of excluded offences, including those under Section 51 of the International Criminal Court Act of 2001. And also there are exclusions relating to Northern Ireland. And I think more specifically, when we consider the third part of the bill in respect of derogation from the ECHR, it is evident that this isn't set out in the strongest possible terms. Specifically, the Act says, in relation to any overseas operations that the Secretary of State considers are or would be significant, the Secretary of State must keep under consideration whether it would be appropriate for the UK to make derogation under Article 15.1 of the Convention. So clearly, it is not set out in the strongest terms. But also, at the same time, there has been some movement in terms of litigation in the European Court of Human Rights that may bear upon this part of the bill. I mentioned earlier on the case of Georgia and Russia number two, and I think it's worth looking at an aspect of that case in respect of derogation. The court in that case made a temporal distinction between the active hostilities phase of the conflict between the 8th and the 12th of August 2008 and the occupation phase after the EU mediated ceasefire on the 12th of August. And in paragraph 143 of the judgment, the court stated the following. The court reiterates in this connection that it does not mean that states can act outside any legal framework. They are obliged to comply with the very detailed rules of international humanitarian law in such a context. In other words, the court was saying that during the active hostilities phase of the conflict, the applicable legal framework was international humanitarian law. And therefore, a derogation in that sense wouldn't be required if the legal framework were to be IHL. That, however, is only in respect of the active hostilities phase. And also, it has to be borne in mind that it makes reference to an international armed conflict. We shall see what the court does next, and an opportunity to do that will be in the case of Hanan and Germany, which is the case that is considering the extent to which human rights law can apply during the armed conflict in Afghanistan, when there were a number of civilian casualties following an airstrike that was authorized by a German colonel in Kunduz. And we will see how the court approaches some of these issues there. Moving back to lawfare more generally, as I mentioned earlier, it could be persuasively argued that lawfare has moved beyond the application of international human rights law to armed conflict and historic claims against former armed forces personnel. Rapid technological developments and the exploitation of hitherto underutilized domains for military purposes will create greater scope for the use of lawfare to potentially exploit legal lacunae. At present, the international law applicable to, amongst other things, the Arctic sea routes, elements of cyber and space warfare, autonomous weapon systems and platforms, artificial intelligence, multi-domain integrated swarms, and human augmentation is, in some senses, far from settled. Such uncertainty allows powerful, well-resourced, and engaged states to influence the development of law in these areas to their advantage and potentially to the detriment of any adversary. In terms of the ability to influence the development of international law, it could be convincingly argued that no state is better positioned to do so than China. Drawing on Maoist tradition, present in Chinese military doctrine since at least 1963 and first codified by the PRC in 2003, the complementary and mutually reinforcing three warfares of public opinion, psychological, and legal warfare stand alone as enduring activity independent of armed conflict. Legal warfare can, of course, be used before, during, and after armed conflict at the strategic, operational, and tactical level pursuant to the Chinese model. And China's twofold legal warfare strategy also seeks to gain what is termed legal principle superiority over any adversary and to legitimize adversary actions. At present, this can be seen most acutely, one could argue, in the South China Sea, which is of considerable geopolitical significance now and will be increasingly so in decades to come. Having ratified the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea China has provided a robust defense of its maritime claims and exploitation of maritime features. Notwithstanding its non-participation in the arbitration brought by the Philippines, in which the Permanent Court of Arbitration award was promulgated in 2016. And China has also repeatedly cited the US lack of legal authority in these matters as a non-ratifying state to UNCLOS. This difficulty caused by the US not ratifying UNCLOS has been recognized by many in the US. Speaking to Army cadets at West Point in 2014, President Obama stated that it's more difficult for the US to push for a resolution of rival maritime claims because the US itself exempts itself from the rules that apply to everyone else. And President Obama specifically stated that it is a lot harder to call on China to resolve its maritime disputes under the Law of the Sea Convention when the US Senate has refused to ratify it, despite the repeated insistence of our top military leaders that the treaty advances our national security. And President Obama went on to say most forcibly, that's not leadership, that's retreat. And again, on the 2nd of June 2016, this time when President Obama was addressing the graduating class at the US Air Force Academy, he stated that if the US are truly concerned about China's actions in the South China Sea, the Senate should help strengthen our case by approving the Law of the Sea Convention, as our military leaders have urged. Nonetheless, however, in 2016, following the arbitral award in the Philippines-China arbitration, President Obama emphasized the importance for China as a signatory to UNCLOS to abide by its obligations under that treaty, which the US views as critical to maintaining the rules-based international order. Irrespective of some inherent legal weaknesses in China's maritime claims in the South China Sea, the US's non-ratifying status in respect of UNCLOS undoubtedly weakens its legal authority, notwithstanding that the US considers UNCLOS to be largely representative of customary international law. It also arguably weakens the legitimacy of US freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea as well. As a signatory to UNCLOS, the UK is not legally exposed during its freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea in the same way, but it could be equally legally exposed elsewhere. The UK's current position in respect of lethal autonomous weapon systems has been publicly expressed in the following terms. The operation of our weapon systems will always be under human control as a guarantee of oversight and authority for weapons release. No UK weapon systems currently in development will be capable of attacking targets without human control, and we have no intention of developing any in the future. As an ardent supporter of the rules-based international order, such a statement is laudable. Through a lawfare lens, however, such a definitive statement could potentially expose the UK to criticism if, at some point in the future, it develops or uses such weapon systems, or alternatively, result in significant military disadvantage, given that potential adversaries may be actively developing such technologies. Each position could be seen as unappealing, but could potentially be resolved by an accurate exposition of the applicable legal framework to new means and methods of warfare. Recognizing the vigor with which China, Russia, non-state actors, and others are pursuing a lawfare agenda, it would be advisable perhaps that the UK in future devote significant resource to this increasingly important area. In so doing, the UK would be able to accurately determine the nature of future lawfare threats and devise credible responses, not unduly hamper the development of new technologies, exploit all warfare domains, and balance competing political and military imperatives. Finally, in the last 5 minutes or so, I would like to offer some thoughts on what the future might hold. I think that that conflict is likely to change significantly in respect of two main categories. There will be others, of course, but two main areas. The future warfare domains is one, and the other is future weapon systems or means or methods of warfare. Turning firstly to future warfare domains. Clearly, the cyber domain has been important for a number of years now and will be increasingly so in the future. This has been recognized by the UK, and in 2020, the UK established the National Cyber Force. In a speech on defence spending, the Prime Minister avowed the UK GCHQ and Ministry of Defence partnership, which is conducting cyber operations to disrupt hostile state activities, terrorists and criminals that threaten the UK's national security. I'm not betraying any secrets, all of this is publicly available, but some examples of the work of the National Cyber Force have included interfering with mobile phones to prevent a terrorist from being able to communicate with their contacts, helping to prevent the internet from being used as a global platform for serious crimes, and keeping military aircraft safe by targeting hostile weapon systems. The second domain that will become increasingly significant in the future is that of space. We have seen that the US has fairly recently established its space force. This did get some publicity, not least of all because some argued that the badge used by the US Space Force bore more than a passing resemblance to that used in Star Trek. But of course, this is a very significant development, and the UK Ministry of Defence is increasingly involved in this area. I think the other domain that is likely to be important in future is in respect of Arctic sea routes. The Northwest Passage and the Northern Sea Route were opened simultaneously in the late 2000s for the first time since satellite measurements began in the 1970s. And any number of states are cognizant of this fact. And fairly recently, China published an Arctic white paper on these issues, because of course, when one looks at trade routes that have opened up as a consequence and will do so in the future, there are significant advantages to be gained. The other main area of future development in warfare is in respect of weapon systems. So there are any number of examples, but to name just a few. Lethal autonomous weapon systems is one, use of artificial intelligence is another, human augmentation, hypersonic missiles, drone swarms. In all of these areas, lawyers will have an increasingly important role to play in terms of assessing the legality of these various different systems. The method by which military lawyers will do that is with reference to Article 36 of Additional Protocol 1, and this will become an increasingly important area of work for military lawyers moving forward. Finally, with violence continuing in Syria, Yemen, the Tigray region of Ethiopia, South Sudan, Mali, an insurgency in Cabo Delgado, border skirmishes between China and India, continued tension between the Ukraine and Russia, a military coup in Myanmar, numerous operations in what has been termed the grey zone, short of armed conflict by many states, there is clearly considerable instability and potential for military operations. I think it is significantly less likely that the UK will be involved in conflicts such as Iraq and Afghanistan moving forward, but it may well be that the UK is called upon in respect of humanitarian missions and humanitarian intervention. As a consequence, the UK's position in terms of humanitarian intervention that was set out in April 2018 will become increasingly important in the future, perhaps. Ultimately, it is an increasingly complex picture that we all face. However, one thing is for certain, there will be an enduring role for those who are involved in this area of academia, and I will continue to be grateful for the quality of everything I read in terms of the work of the fellows of the Lauterpacht Centre and elsewhere. And I thank you again for some of the excellent work that you've done. Thank you very much indeed for your time. I really appreciate it. And I would be delighted to answer any questions on the subject of this talk or anything else that you think might be important. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Ian. We benefit from you, from lectures like this one that is so comprehensive, wide-ranging, and enlightening us about current and future challenges.